Yeah, you can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for your support. Chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, partly to mostly cloudy, lows in the low to mid 50s, patchy fog early tomorrow, then becoming sunny, high 67 to 75. Support comes from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. It's time for As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Worst laid plans. The White House says its meeting today is about a prosperous future for Gaza and Israel, but a former U.S. negotiator tells us he's skeptical about those promises and whether there's actual political will to bring the ceasefire so many are desperate for.
And Topical Island. An intensive project is underway to remove a blight from the Thames River in London, a monstrosity known as Wet Wipe Island. We'll check in on the progress of the cleanup and find out what it will take to wipe out masses of wet wipes.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on People Powered KAXC. Thanks for tuning in. Support comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services, hosting the 17th Annual Community Connect Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. We're going to take a listen now to our album of the week. It is by Ketch Secor. It's called Story the Crow Told Me. Secor is a founding member of Old Crow Medicine Show, here with a solo album. You can think of him as a highly caffeinated Tom Waits with a banjo. You can read more about this album at our website, kaxc.org. The song we're going to hear this evening is called Dickerson Road.
Screen door rather the bars. He's got one shoe, gas can stuck in his arms. Y'all pick and give a dollar for a gallon or two. I'm about to break through, check my tape out due. At the Aztec burnout lot, she's got pipes, sleep all day, creep all night. She's in a hornet's jacket, jaywalking, buzzing by. And if she don't make it, well, she'll die trying. Stray dog licking at the grease trap. Piece of that pork chop scattered in dice. That's right, he's such a nice dog. Fetch boy, he don't bite. A night, he just might. Freak shows coming to town on a rail. They opened up the jails, let the cons come running. Got any songs that really say something? No, man, give me a smoke, I'm just bumming.
Honky tonk the highway, back door to Broadway. Stay with the sky, stay down on Dickerson Road. Dickerson Road. Motel Jeep thrill rolling up a dollar bill. My mama, big deal down on Dickerson Road.
This old postman grabbed my arm, tried to get me to hear his song by the Piggly Wiggly. Said he used to blow some sacks with Jimmy at the old Star Dam. Like, yeah, that sounds pretty. Next Apple Annie's is a sweet Mercado where they wait to hear someone say Trabajo. And send their dough on down to Durango. Tell them how Tennessee's the end of the rainbow. Truck stop girl, barefoot at the Crystal drive-thru. She's got the Revelation hairdo. $3 more is all I need to get my life back together. Pretty please.
Honky tonk the highway, back door to Broadway. Stay where the sky, stay down on Dickerson Road. Dickerson Road. And that's a motel, cheap thrill, rolling up a dollar bill. My mama, big deal down on Dickerson Road.
Oh!
Up on the hill where they built the new Walmart, there used to be a section of hardwoods, hard-fought, hard-living mama, and I won't be gone until the radio DJ pushes my song. They say the more twisted the branch, the deeper the root, and I want to break through, but I can't cut loose like they hear that in a country song. Instead of all these pretty boys banging the gong.
Honky tonk the highway, back door to Broadway, stay where the stars stay, down on Dickerson Road. Hotel cheap thrill, rolling up a dollar bill. My mama big deal down on Dickerson Road. Down on Dickerson Road. Dickerson Road.
And let us know what you think of our album of the week. Text us 218-326-1234. That is Ketch Seeker. The song is Dickerson Road from his album Story the Crow Told Me. We'll continue with As It Happens here in a few moments on KAXC. And 7 o'clock tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. More great music at 10 o'clock with Headwaters, Kari Hedlund, your host. And tune in for a special interview with Alan Sparhawk, who will be performing at Grand Rapids Riverfest Saturday, September 6. We'll also have that interview available at KAXC.org. But yes, we are looking forward to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Join us September 6. We'll have Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. More information, GrandRapidsRiverfest.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Dreaming scenario while the Israeli military prepares to conquer famine-stricken Gaza City. Donald Trump and friends prepare for a post-war Gaza, but a former Middle East negotiator tells us he has no confidence their plans will come to fruition.
End of the rainbow. A survivor of the 2016 mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Florida says the state's move to erase rainbow crosswalks really highlights the governor's true colors.
Radio silence after dramatic cuts to their funding. The future of public radio in the U.S. is precarious. And in some communities, the loss of a station would be the loss of a lifeline.
Abandoned shipping. Canadian small business owners face the end of duty-free shipping to the U.S., which means they're facing some tough decisions.
Good cops, bad cop. At least that is how two members of the band The Police see it. And they're suing their lead singer, claiming he puts the sting in Stingy.
And never throw in the towelette. The Port Authority in London is finally tackling what might be its most daunting, disgusting task yet, removing a giant agglomeration of stuff that wound up in the River Thames after people flushed it, known as Wet Wipe Island. As It Happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that hates to end things on a sewer note. A White House official described it as simply a policy meeting, but the people at that meeting, including President Donald Trump, were discussing plans for a post-war Gaza, which, of course, is not simple at all. Mr. Trump held the meeting as Israel's military continues to expand its offensive in Gaza City, warning that a population displacement is, quote, inevitable. And while every member state on the United Nations Security Council, except for the U.S., called for a ceasefire in Gaza at a press conference today. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former U.S. State Department Middle East negotiator. We reached him in Oxford, Maine.
Aaron, as you know, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East has said, using the kind of language that we've heard from the president before, that the U.S. is going to settle this war, but they're going to settle it before the end of this year. Do you believe that?
I'd like to. Having been around Israeli-Palestinian negotiations for Republican and Democratic presidents for the better part of a quarter century, one thing I know is that if you're serious about a plan, you don't begin to talk about it on TV, and you certainly don't give deadlines. The late Prime Minister Rabin used to say there are no sacred dates, and the truth is that's sad in some respects, but the reality is that On this one, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, even mediated by international actors have only two speeds, slow and slower. So I would like to believe it. I think it's great that they're beginning to focus on the day after. It's a long time coming for the hostages, their families, and the long-suffering 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, more than half of whom are children.
And talking about the day after the war ends is important, certainly, but can that be a productive or useful conversation at this stage when a ceasefire does not seem close?
It's a fascinating question, and I think a ceasefire or a cessation of hostilities is going to be critically important, because if you're seriously talking about a day after, you're really talking about three key questions that have to be answered. Number one, who or what is going to govern Gaza? Number two, who or what is going to create security architecture to maintain law and order and to any additional terror and violence that might come, and also to constrain what the Israelis may be prepared to do? And finally, who, what, and how are you going to reconstruct an area roughly twice the size of the District of Columbia, with one of the highest population densities in the world, where you have 2 million residents? These are the kinds of questions that require time, space, relative tranquility in order to address. But, you know, more important than all of those things, leadership. Leaders are prepared to demonstrate the political will to make what will prove to be very difficult decisions.
On that issue of what, you know, who could lead after a ceasefire, Shaharbal al-Zaim is an appointee as justice minister for the Palestinian Authority. I'll play for you and our listeners a little bit of what he told BBC News earlier today.
To get Gaza back to the right direction and hopefully rebuild Gaza, the Palestinian Authority should go back to govern the life of the people in the Gaza Strip and move forward toward a better future for the Gazans, for Palestine and the Middle East.
Again, the possibility of that and an election to get to that point all seems very far away, at least to me, you know, very far away from the conflict itself. What about for you?
Palestinians are faced with two impalpable choices, one Hamas and the other Mahmoud Abbas. And while Abbas is, in my judgment, a man committed to a peaceful resolution of this conflict, when we worked with him, the reality is that he's weak. He's perceived to be corrupt and with authoritarian instincts. The problem is that I don't think the Palestinians are going to get to choose. This day after plan, I'm sure, certain, will not involve elections anytime soon. I think what they have in mind is to create a technocratic government with links to the Palestinian Authority. Links and not the Palestinian Authority itself, for two reasons. Number one, I don't think that the current government of Israel would accept the emergence of the Palestinian Authority to govern Gaza. And number two, I don't think the Palestinian Authority is in any position right now, both with respect to security or governance, to take over those responsibilities. And this day after plan, I suspect, given who's advising the Trump administration, will perhaps understandably from their point of view, and maybe from reality's point of view, have a high degree of sensitivity and pro-Israeli sensibilities. So I think what you're looking at is a technocratic government, which has some legitimacy, not Hamas, not Abbas, with links, perhaps, to the Palestinian Authority, which after reform and perhaps elections, might then assume the role of governing in Gaza. So we're talking about a transition period of a year or more, I suspect.
In terms of who is in that meeting, who is advising, there are reports from BBC, Axios, CNN as well, that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the U.S. president, who does not have a role in government, an official role anyway, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair are in that room. That will be concerning to a lot of people, as you can imagine, who are listening. What do you make of their inclusion?
I mean, Tony Blair's been at this for quite some time. He's done some extremely important work. I think his instincts are probably right. Jared Kushner, who I got to meet several times during Trump 1.0, I can only make the following comment, that if, in fact, what Jared Kushner is advising is anywhere remotely within the vicinity of the deal of the century, which was a peace plan which was articulated in 2020, which was dead upon arrival, then Houston, we have a problem. The issue, I think, is whether or not you can square the circle, or maybe it's a triangle now, among the current government of Israel, the most right-wing in Israel's history, presided over by a prime minister who's on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in Jerusalem District Court, and frankly doesn't want the Palestinian Authority involved because his coalition partners that threaten to revolt has no interest in a negotiation leading to two states, produce the same outcome in terms of a coalition crisis. How do you reconcile all of that with Kiev states that are expected to fund this and perhaps even deploy security forces? They will insist on a Palestinian Authority role, a reformed Palestinian Authority. They're going to insist on some bridge between Gaza on one hand and the future of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and conflict on the other. That's going to be, I think, of all the aspects of this, trying to find a balance among those interests and then try to implement it. That's why I am colorably very skeptical on what we're watching play out right now.
Aaron, I appreciate this as always. Thank you.
Neil, thanks so much for having me.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former U.S. State Department Middle East negotiator. He's in Oxford, Maine. They had the rug pulled out from under them, and now public broadcasters in the U.S. are struggling to get back on their feet. Last month, the United States Congress passed a bill that clawed back more than $1 billion from public broadcasting. That was in response to President Donald Trump's demand to pull funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In the weeks since, the cuts have put hundreds of local stations across the U.S. at risk, including some where this program airs. 27 of the threatened stations are in Alaska, including KUCB, which serves residents of the small Aleutian Islands community of Unalaska. Lauren Adams is the station manager, and we reached her in Unalaska.
Lauren, obviously there had been a lot of talk before these cuts, you know, in the weeks leading up to it at least. Was there a part of you that thought that this won't actually happen?
Oh, absolutely. I think that I was pretty naive looking back, certainly very optimistic. I guess I felt that because the funding is allocated 2 years in advance, that we had that little bit of padding, that we would have that 2 years to plan for. Mm-hmm. And the way that it went down, as you know, we didn't have that time. Our fiscal year started on July 1st. So we already had those funds in our budget. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they were gone.
So again, to underline, the budget had already been approved, and we should mention half of your funding comes or came from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, more than $250,000 U.S. So given all of that, what has this meant for your operations? What does it mean right now?
Yeah, so yes, we had a very large portion of our budget came from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. 46% was kind of what we were looking at. And what does that mean now? Well, this time last year, I had four local reporters. We cover a huge region of Alaska, the Aleutian and Pribilof region. Our newsroom is the only newsroom based in these islands. We had four reporters, and today we have two reporters on KUCB staff. We had a morning host that would be on the air talking about current weather conditions, what's going on in the community, and that position is gone. So we've seen real significant cuts to staff. Mm-hmm. And we're not there yet. You know, that got us the breathing room to kind of plan for our future and start working on transformation. But, you know, it's going to take time.
There are fundraising efforts underway, at least one, I should say, to try to get money for stations in Alaska, including yours. But what are your listeners saying? Because what you talked about there, that's really lifeline or, as is often said in the business, survival information.
We're drawing from a very small pool of people who can give and a very small pool of businesses. And so there's only so much money we can raise in our community. And so there is no way that we would be able to make those funds up with local fundraising. I am working with colleagues statewide. There's a larger fund trying to raise funds for all 27 stations in the state of Alaska through philanthropic dollars. That would be a bridge fund to try to help keep stations on the air as we kind of look to the future.
And what are people there saying about, you know, the downsizing, the changes, the cuts overall?
Yeah, so our community, you know, I think it's real. It's pretty brand new still. Mm-hmm. We did have a summer intern who kind of kept our services going at their level throughout the summer. And I think just now, as she's gone back to school and we're down to our skeleton crew, I think that it's starting to sink in for all of us, for staff here as well as for the community, that there's no way that we can provide the same level of service without those funds.
When the vote to rescind funding was happening last month, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski went against many of her Republican counterparts, her party, and opposed this bill. She spoke to reporters at that time. We'll play for you and our listeners a little bit of what she said then.
There has been probably no issue, no single issue that has drawn out more interest across the state of Alaska than support for public broadcasting. I come from a state that is extraordinarily rural. I come from a state where access to other forms of information and communication may be limited. It may be everything may just come by way of your radio.
And you've had recent examples even of how important a lifeline that radio can be.
Yeah, so it was crazy timing, actually, because while the debate was happening on the Senate floor here in Unalaska, we had a tsunami warning, and it was not just an advisory, it was a warning, which means our entire community and the entire processing industry has to go to high ground. And that, you know, that happens sometimes in Unalaska. It's not a rare occurrence. And so that day, there's a siren that rings, and then there's a vocal component that says, tune in to your local radio station mm-hmm. for more information. And so we were on the air live as soon as the siren went out, and the evacuation went off very well. And so I emailed Lisa Murkowski that day to mm-hmm. say that that here's an example of yeah. why public media is so necessary in Alaska. It's we're here for the health and safety of our community, and this is the work we do. It's not partisan work. It wasn't even reporting work in that case. It was just a simple emergency alert message that needed to go out, and that was the best way to do it.
Public service. Yeah.
Yes.
Where do you imagine, Lauren, you and KUCB might be at this time next year?
Well, we're working really hard on that. I mean, the hard part with losing such a large piece of funding is we haven't really even had time to visualize where we'll be in a year. You know, honestly, I'm having my first meeting with my board of directors tonight to just say, hey, here's what our budget looks like. I've had zero time since the rescission happened. It's just been nonstop. We're having lots of meetings statewide trying to figure out how we can work more closely together as a system, how we can consolidate more operations, what stations we can repeat if we can't provide a local service. We're doing hyper local reporting in a community very far away from the epicenter of the United States politics. And there aren't commercial entities lined up to step in and try to take that place. You know, if we're gone, that service is gone.
Well, Lauren, I appreciate you taking time out of what is a busy time for you to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren Adams is the manager of KUCB in Unalaska, Alaska. That's where we reached her. The River Thames, known throughout history for its sparkling, crystal-clear water, which Londoners famously scoop out with their hands and slurp down on their way to work. I'm just kidding. The Thames is gross, and what I'm about to tell you is not going to improve anyone's opinion of it. For years, people have been flushing their wet wipes down the toilet, and they've been collecting at a specific spot in the Thames that's become known as Wet Wipe Island. This agglomeration of soggy bathroom debris has taken over around 250 meters of shoreline. It's estimated to weigh 180 tons. And now the city is out to clean it up. Emily McLean is a senior technical advisor with the Port of London Authority. She's overseeing the wet wipe excavation. We reached her in London.
Emily, I was just, I can't believe it, steps away from where all of this is happening just a few weeks ago, and I missed it. I didn't see any of Wet Wipe Island. I don't know, is that a good or a bad thing as someone who is visiting London?
I think from a distance, it's quite hard to tell on the foreshore, like what is like the natural riverbed and right. What are the wet wipes. But then when you're up close, you can definitely see the kind of congealed wet wipes. So yeah, I'm not surprised that you didn't notice it, because we've had a lot of people who have come by and were like, I didn't even know that this was there. But yeah, it's crazy when you actually see the scale of the issue.
When you do get up close, I mean, I got a sense of it there and it doesn't sound pretty, but when you're up close there and the folks, the volunteers cleaning it up, what if I were to walk right up to it, what would I see?
So all of these wet wipes that have kind of come through the sewer system, they've been mixed in with the kind of river sediment. So they're all brown and they all get mixed in together. They form this horrible sort of congealed mass, and then it mixes in with other bits of litter. So it just forms these great big mounds that we've had in Hammersmith. And yeah, there's just hundreds of thousands of wet wipes there when you get up close.
And, you know, I remember 2017, 2018, our colleagues in London doing a story about the Fatberg crisis in the sewer system. One would think that there would have been measures put in place or changes made. People are still flushing these wipes.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really complex story. The packaging on some of the wet wipes, it kind of describes them as flushable.
Yeah.
But we don't know how biodegradable these wipes are. So, you know, we really encourage people to not flush them down the toilet, you know, to dispose them properly. Because, yeah, otherwise they end up going into the sewer system. And sometimes if that sewer system's overloaded, then they get flushed into the river, really, unfortunately.
Yes.
And then it forms these problems that we've got.
It says that on packaging here too, in Canada certainly, and perhaps elsewhere. So it's good that folks are hearing your advice if they haven't heard it already. So that's what it looks like. What I mean, is there a smell associated with it too?
I mean, we've been very lucky that we haven't, when the works have been happening, we haven't actually noticed any smells.
Okay, that's good.
Which has been one of the unexpected positives of the project.
They took it on, these volunteers took that on, even with that as a possibility. So that says a lot about them. How do you and your team, how have you been tackling, you know, the cleanup?
So, well, given the scale of the problem, you know, we had to sort a different approach. Today, all of the efforts to clean the wet wipes have kind of relied on people removing them by hand. So we commissioned an independent ecological study, and we developed an environmentally responsible way to use these mechanical excavators with a special called rake and shake technique, where they rake the foreshore to sort of sieve the wet wipes from the natural riverbed. So ensuring that, you know, that sediment remains on the river where it should be, but just taking away those contaminated wet wipes. And then those have been taken away for disposal. And we're doing that to remove these islands, essentially.
How far along in the process are you?
So we've been going since the start of August. We're nearly there. The project is due to be completed by the end of the week. So, yeah, we're really excited to finally see these mounds and islands gone.
These volunteers with Thames 21, what have they told you about why they want to do this?
I think there's been, you know, understandably frustration from the local community and the volunteers that these wet wipes have ended up in the river. You know, they're all really passionate about the Thames and the environment and keeping it clean, and we really agree with that, and we've been frustrated too. So I think they're finally so relieved and satisfied to see the wet wipes gone, and you know, we really hope that this project will have a really positive impact for the environment.
But also, why is it down to a team of volunteers to do it? Why wouldn't this be automatically something the city takes care of?
I mean, we've been working really closely with the environmental charity Thames 21 over the last 5 years to help them monitor the process. You know, they've been advocating for this change and for these wet wipes to be removed. And so we've been working really closely with them to monitor the site, get a really good database in terms of the scale of the problem. And we think that And now with the new London super sewer coming online, this is like the perfect opportunity to get these wet wipes out of the river so that they don't reaccumulate.
And are there other spots where there are, it's so funny to call them wet wipe islands, but that's what they've become known as. Are there other spots that will have to be tackled as well? Like why was the accumulation at this particular spot at Hammersmith?
So due to the kind of bend in the river, this particular site has been, you know, the wet wipes grew there quite significantly, and it's been monitored really thoroughly, which has allowed us to kind of do the work. And, you know, this is the first time anyone in the country has undertaken a mass removal of wet wipes to this scale. So we're kind of breaking new ground and we want to learn lessons, but we know that there are other sites where there are other bits of litter and wet wipes in the river. So we're hoping that we can learn lessons on how this project works to see if it's something that we can roll out to kind of other areas in the river too.
I appreciate this, Emily. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to speak to you.
Emily McLean is a senior technical advisor for the Port of London Authority, and we reached her in London. And if you want to see what Wet Wipe Island looks like, and who could blame you, head to our website at cbc.ca/AIH. Sounds weird. For 42 years, this song about a possessive lover has followed all of us around like a possessive lover, so we know it's not supposed to sound like this. This is a demo version that Sting, the lead singer of the band The Police, recorded on his own before showing his bandmates. They argued bitterly about what it should sound like, which was mostly what they did at that time, and then guitarist Andy Summers came up with a part and recorded it in a single take. Have to play this, you already know every single squeak of his fingers on the strings. But that riff is a big part of why Every Breath You Take was the only number one song The Police ever had in the US. It's a big part of the reason why Every Breath You Take was honored in 2019 by the American rights group Broadcast Music Incorporated as the most played song in radio history, which has made Sting, who has sole songwriting credit, very rich, and Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland less rich. But over the decades, every move he's maked, every claim he's staked, they've been watching him. And now Mr. Summers and Mr. Copeland are reportedly suing Mr. Sting for lost royalties. And to give you an idea of what kind of royalties we're talking about, he apparently makes over $1 million Canadian a year from this song. It's kind of a shame to see them bickering, even if they were renowned for bickering. And I'm sorry if you thought they were best friends. If you did, this story really might defund the police. Police with King of Pain.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, the state of Florida targets rainbow crosswalks, and a BC couple gets grilled when they accidentally become customer service agents for a barbecue brand.
Plus, a small business owner in Quebec tells us what the end of a long-standing U.S. tariff exemption is going to mean for her. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, then partly to mostly cloudy, lows 53 to 56. Patchy fog early tomorrow, then becoming mostly sunny, highs 67 to 75. For Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 70s. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Alcott Park, starting at 4 o'clock with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. There is more ahead from As It Happens.
For the first time since 2017, the intersection in front of the former Pulse nightclub in Orlando looks like every other crosswalk in town, except that the police are guarding it. Until last week, it was a rainbow crosswalk, honoring the 49 people killed in the 2016 mass shooting at the gay nightclub. Then, under cover of darkness, state transportation officials painted over the rainbow with dark gray paint. The next day, members of the community turned it back into a rainbow, but on the weekend, state workers painted over it again. Under Governor Ron DeSantis, the Department of Transportation has ordered communities across Florida to remove all rainbow crosswalks and street art by early next month. On Twitter, the governor posted, quote, "We will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes," unquote. So local city councils are trying to find ways to preserve 2S LGBTQ plus art while following the directive, or risk losing millions of dollars in state funding. Brandon Wolf is a survivor of the Pulse nightclub shooting. He's the spokesperson for Human Rights International, a 2S LGBTQ plus organization. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Brandon, as a survivor of that shooting and someone who lost friends there, what does the loss of those colors on that crosswalk mean for you?
I think it's so important for us to put this in context because it's about so much more than paint on concrete. That crosswalk is a memorial to the deadliest terror attack on U.S. soil since 9/11, a memorial to 49 mostly LGBTQ plus people of color who were stolen that night, a memorial to hundreds of people who barely escaped the club with their lives, and a community that was turned upside down. So when I see the state come in and use it as a political punching bag to turn our sacred, hallowed ground into a political talking point, it makes me furious. It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart to see Governor Ron DeSantis, a man who has made his entire political identity about terrorizing LGBTQ plus people. It breaks my heart to see him desecrate the memories of the people that I loved so much.
What are your friends who are still there? You're in Washington, as we've said. What have they been telling you about what's been going on? You know, the painting, they painted it back, as our listeners heard, then it was painted over again. What are they telling you about how they're dealing with it, what they're planning to do?
Yeah, I think they share that sense of heartbreak. I think they share that sense of rage, of anger. But I also, you know, the thing I love about the Orlando community is that it is a community a little blue dot in a sea of very red. And as a result, they pride themselves in their sense of resistance, of defiance. So what I'm hearing from my friends is a resolve to, you know, continue to show up for each other, to bathe the city in rainbows. That one rainbow crosswalk has become hundreds of other rainbows all over the city. And that speaks to the character of Orlando. No one is going to allow Ron DeSantis to have the last word here. And that's the feeling I'm getting from them.
You know, you mentioned politics, of course. U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, as you well know, has said this is, you know, in his directive said that roads are for safety and not political messages or artwork. They're saying that sidewalks or crosswalks have been co-opted for political messaging. What do you say to that line of thinking?
Well, first and foremost, it's important to name that all of the data tells us that bright, colorful crosswalks are better for pedestrian safety. So if we want to have a debate about safety, then that's a debate they're going to lose. And then, you know, when we're talking about the politics of it all, the truth is, it is not political to honor and respect the memories of people who had their lives stolen. It is not political for this community to have gone to the state of Florida and gotten approval to put in a memorial so that we could remind ourselves what happened that night. It is not political for us to put up symbols of love, of compassion, of reminders that we will never let hate win. The only person making this political right now is Governor Ron DeSantis. The only people making this political right now are right-wing Republicans who are using the LGBTQ plus community once again as a scapegoat for this country's problems and as a way to avoid talking about the fact that they don't have any solutions to people's real problems. So I would just argue, if I had the chance to talk to Secretary Duffy, that it is not political for us to want to honor our friends. The only person making it political is the one who's inserting politics into a memorial space.
We know that Fort Lauderdale officials there are holding an emergency meeting to talk about this. In St. Petersburg, according to the Associated Press, the mayor there, Kenneth Welch, has said at a news briefing, said that they're going to look at having other flags, banners, other kinds of installations because they couldn't find a way to save their street murals and to find powerful expressions, as the mayor said, expressions that cannot be erased. Does that give you hope that even in the sea of red that you described, that there is so much discussion and pushback at that city official level across the state or many parts of the state?
You know, keep in mind, ours is a community that has always taken backlash and turned it into resistance, resilience, and progress. So it gives me a lot of hope. And I would just say to Ron DeSantis, to Donald Trump, underestimate us at your own risk. You may erase one crosswalk here or try to take a flag down there, and all that will happen is that people will put up 100 more in response, because this is a community that has never been erased with one bucket of black paint, who's never been erased by one politician with, you know, insatiable ambition. So underestimate them at your own risk, because you're going to see a lot more of what you're hearing from Mayor Welch in St. Pete, from what you're hearing from Mayor Dyer in Orlando and other places. You're going to hear resistance and resilience.
You're talking about this, obviously, doing interviews like this one. What will you be doing next?
Well, first, I send my love to everyone who is raising their flag higher than ever. And I would encourage you, if you've wondered how to get into the fight for a better future, this is an on-ramp for you. You don't have to do much more than, say, turn your driveway into a rainbow, turn your sidewalk into an art mural. You have all the tools in front of you to be part of sending a message that we cannot be erased.
What would you say to a young person who is listening and is growing up in a different Florida?
Wow. I was you not that long ago. I grew up in rural Oregon and had a really hard time living in a community that didn't look like me, didn't love like me. That's why I moved 3,000 miles away to Orlando, Florida, to find somewhere where I could be unapologetically myself. So I guess what I'd have to say to the younger version of me is you're not alone. There are millions of people just like me who are fighting for you every single day, and we will not rest until this country is safe and free and equal so that you can go out and be the very best version of yourself. And the other thing I would say is, You don't need permission to be unapologetically you. The world needs you in your fullest form. And while we're fighting, I would encourage you to just be you proudly, unapologetically, audaciously you, because the world needs you just like that.
I appreciate this, Brandon. Thank you.
Thank you. Anytime.
Brandon Wolfe lost two close friends in the 2016 mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. He now works for Human Rights International in Washington, D.C. The smell of sunscreen, the buzz of cicadas, and the sizzle of a backyard barbecue. This summer, that sizzle got a little louder for Mirjana Komljenovich and her husband Jim Claussen of Summerland, BC. They love their Napoleon grill so much that they accidentally became customer service representatives for the company. For over 6 months, the couple has been fielding hundreds of calls from across Canada and the U.S. after Jim's phone number somehow wound up on Google as Napoleon's customer service line. To honor their hard work, Napoleon will present them with a special recognition tomorrow. And to celebrate the occasion, there will also be a barbecue.
We use our Napoleon quite often. We love our Napoleon. It's made in Canada. That was what we wanted, made and assembled here. And we've had it for a number of years, and we use it throughout the year. So it's time to upgrade a little piece of it. So Jim phoned Barrie, Ontario, asking some questions. That's where the head office is. And had asked a few questions about this particular part, you know, where he could get it. Well, he learned that he could get it at White's Barbecue over in Kelowna. So he went over to White's and purchased the piece for an upgrade. And then a couple of days later, suddenly he had a phone call, somebody on the other line saying, "Hi, is this Napoleon?" And Jim was like, "Huh? No, this isn't Napoleon. This is Jim." Oh, he says, this number was on the Google website. And so Jim was curious, like, "Oh, okay, ever since when?" And he says, "I just looked at it a few minutes ago." And Jim said, I'm sorry, I did call there, but we wanted a part or whatever. So they started talking. And lo and behold, he needed a part too. He had a similar situation with his Sizzler, and he wanted to upgrade as well. So the two started having a conversation. No big deal. A couple of days later, he phoned Napoleon, said, "You know, my number is on your guys' Google website. I don't think you want that."
And then it went right across the whole web. I was talking to a lot of people right across Canada.
And we were getting calls even from the States, and they would ask things like, "Oh, how's the weather over there?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's it like to live in the Okanagan?" And it was really a lot of fun. It just felt like the most Canadian thing to do. So that's what we did. We just helped out wherever we could. If Jim could answer a question about Napoleon, he would. And then he would direct them to either their local barbecue store or at White's, who were kind enough to take in some of the calls. We were actually getting sometimes up to 20 phone calls a day.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, how many calls do you think you got all together? Like, because this went on for about 6 months, right?
Hundreds. We didn't, keep score.
Yeah.
But it was hundreds.
Mirjana Komljenovich and her husband, Jim Claussen of Summerland, BC, talking to Sarah Penton, host of Radio West in Kelowna. It's a legal term that comes from Latin. It means of little importance. But for some Canadian business owners, upcoming changes to the de minimis exemption are, in fact, of major importance. That long-standing exemption allowed shipments worth less than $800 to enter the United States duty-free. But earlier this year, President Donald Trump moved to close that loophole. The change comes into effect on Friday. Tamara Bavdek is a designer and owner of This Ilk Jewelry. She's in Montreal.
Tamara, in the 16 years you've been in business, how does what is happening with this exception fit in terms of obstacles or troubles you've had?
It's definitely a first, and I haven't experienced anything quite similar to this before, to be honest.
How would you describe to listeners the kind of impact a move like this could have on your bottom line?
You know, you plan your whole business and you evolve throughout time and build a customer base, and a lot of it, you know, the states are, for us, are basically local because it's very close and easy to ship to in general. Being, you know, a small business, I've also used Etsy, which is a U.S.-based mm-hmm. company, to sell my goods. And then a lot of even the websites are they start off as a U.S. company and then they have a Canadian division. So it's always been like natural to just sell to the USA for us. And yeah, it just made so much sense. You wouldn't think, you know, it's something that you wouldn't have access to at one point.
So it's sort of reconfiguring everything, it sounds like. So how do you deal with that? Are you even sleeping at this point? What are your days like?
Well, there's a lot of questions. Just about every day I've been kind of searching the web, trying to find answers to questions and see mm-hmm. if someone's come up with an easier solution to the issue, or have more information about, like, will my package get stuck? What should I be telling my customers? How are other people going about doing this? Every day there's a bit of that going on. Someone's asking me, will I get this on time? Should I order? Should I wait? Shops in the U.S. are asking if they should order at this time, or even I have to go up front and say, like, right now I don't think you should place an order. It's best to wait and see what happens. Just looking for answers.
and we have heard from some small business owners that they've actually been trying to rush out orders before the deadline. You're advising a different plan of action at this point. We know Etsy has suspended Canada Post shipping labels for now. So how does that part of things, you mentioned that platform. So if a customer in the US was going to your Etsy page today, are they automatically seeing higher shipping costs? What would they encounter?
No, not at the moment. Mm-hmm. So right now, I haven't adjusted anything, and I'm kind of questioning what exactly I'm adjusting. Where am I changing things? I haven't made the move yet. So one of the things, so I did rush orders earlier last week. I was very much rushing orders to get them out because I'm pretty sure that things are going to get held up in customs. So not only, you know, even if you're doing everything the right way, I don't think that they're prepared to receive that amount of items to add duty to or to charge anyway. So I think it's going to be a bit of a mess in any case. So I'm kind of holding off just to make sure nobody's going to expect something in a reasonable delay and then, you know, have to wait. So that's one of the things. And then, of course, for my product and specifically, it's mostly made in Canada. And I mean, it's pretty much, you know, I use materials from all over, but even a lot of them are US-based materials. So technically, I would be part of the CUSMA free trade agreement. And so for a very small business, we're not really sure how we're supposed to go about declaring this or
there's some paperwork that can be filled out, I think, right, to exempt you. But even that's not clear at this stage.
It's not clear. It's not clear if that's going to be a smooth, you know, go through smoothly. I don't know who verifies these things. I don't know if there's some sort of auditing that's the thing. When you haven't faced this before, you have no idea what to expect. And then if things get held up, then you can be in trouble. So I don't even know if I should try that because I'm not even sure it's going to work at the moment. So for now, I'm thinking of testing out, you know, if I get a few smaller orders, ship them and kind of monitor what happens. And
let the customers know that this is the situation that they might have to deal with. What are your customers saying?
It seems like another issue is like that as time goes by, people are more and more used to getting things instantly. So this is like an issue when you're a small business making things by hand and then taking the time to ship them. It's also that you have to communicate extra. So we're like, you know, we're losing time trying to make people aware and letting them know that you don't even know, and then like trying to make them feel secure about their purchase. So
just describe some of what you make for our listeners and the price range that you're dealing with.
Yeah, so I work with vintage lace, and I make mostly statement earrings, but I make necklaces and body jewelry and bracelets as well. So they're like lightweight, but quite large pieces. The vintage lace has been sourced. A lot of it was actually made in the U.S. because there used to be an industry that has pretty much since died out. And I've been collecting this lace for years, for 16 years. They start at like around 30 and they go up to 140, depending on the amount of time, the materials, how rare it is, how long they take. Yeah, all that.
So under normal circumstances, very much within the realm of the exemption.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Is there something that the Canadian government could or should do in your view to help you?
I think there's a lot that could be done. Definitely just educate us with what we should be doing. Definitely something to help out artisans. You know, maybe there's some sort of document like pre-filled or just some sort of help, some maybe legal help that could be like a service that we call into mm-hmm. and make sure like we're filling this out properly to get to have access to the CUSMA advantages. Yeah, definitely working with Canada Post probably to get to make things clarity. Really streamlined mm-hmm. and having extra help somewhere down the line would definitely make a difference.
Tamara, I appreciate this. Good luck with everything. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for reaching out.
We reached jewelry designer and business owner Tamara Bavdek in Montreal. We all spend a really significant amount of our lives at work, which is great. It's great. But none of us has racked up as many hours on the job as Mervyn McPhee. Not that he's complaining. Mr. McPhee started working as a butcher after learning the craft from his father. He is the second of four generations of McPhees to work at McPhee's Meats in Clyde River, PEI. And earlier this month, he celebrated his 92nd birthday. He still goes to work every day, and he still hits the road to drop off custom deliveries. It might seem like a big job for someone in their 90s, but Mr. McPhee doesn't exactly feel his age.
Probably 59. I'm telling you, that's what I feel. If my legs were a little better, I'd be as good as you were. Do you know that?
You'd want to be better than me, I tell you.
Maybe we better erase this then altogether then.
And you've already been out doing deliveries this morning.
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
You know, it's great to get up in the morning at my age and put my foot in the floor and say, boy, I got something to do. Now, they're not going to say, oh, boy, am I glad to see you. That's here I'm talking about, you know?
But they tell me you come in the door every day and you say, what do you want me to do? What do you got for me to do?
Well, they don't start clapping. They don't start clapping, I'll tell you, fella.
You know, as you say, you put your foot on the floor and you've got something to do every day. How important is that, do you think, to everyone?
That is something. To be my age, that is good. I'm happy.
Now, what's your favorite part of the workday?
Oh, what's my favorite part? Well, I don't know. It's all like when I get cut doing the custom stuff. I like that so much. It's just I like it. I'm so happy that I can do it. See, I lost my wife about a year ago with dementia, but every night I want people to hear this. Mom's pictured there. And I say, Mom, I'm going to bed now. And I know she's waiting. She's got her hands full.
You're not in any rush, though.
Oh, I'd go anytime, but I don't think they want me that soon, you know?
Mervyn McPhee is still working at his family business in Clyde River, PEI. He was talking to the CBC's Mitch Cormier.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. My name is Sarah Serra, and this program is On the River. We have some weather for you, and it is a slight chance of shower.